Today's program was brought to you by Sushi Master, the new book by Nick Sakagami.
This week on Meat and Three, we're exploring interactions from drug studies in a laboratory.
If this effect is as big as he's saying, somebody should have discovered this long before he did.
To global wisdom on avoiding hangovers.
Beber cerveza antes de tomar vino no previene los síntomas.
Bière sur vin et venant, vin sur bière et belle manière.
Beer before wine, you're going to be fine. Wine before beer, you're going to be queer.
To the novel recipes developed by an Indian American family deep in the heart of Texas.
And then my mom's sort of coming to America and learning that white parents love to melt cheese on things to get their kids to eat it. She was like, this is genius.
Be sure to subscribe to Meat in Three. That's M-E-A-T plus sign T-H-R-E-E. Available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome to A Hungry Society. I'm Korsha Wilson, and this is a show where we talk about food, food media, and so much more. Today's guest is Clay Williams, a Brooklyn-based photographer specializing in food, drinks, and events. He photographs assignments for the New York Times, the James Beard Foundation, and the Wall Street Journal. Clay is a member of the board of Slow Food NYC, and with Colleen Vincent is the co-founder of Black Food Folks, a fellowship of Black professionals in food media, service, and events. His latest book, 111 Rooftops in New York That You Must Not Miss, written by Leslie Adato, comes out this month from Emmons and is available for pre-order on Amazon. Clay!
Hi!
Welcome to Hungry Society!
Thank you very much.
I'm so glad you're here.
Yeah, me too. This is great.
In the intro, I wanted to throw in Brooklyn born and raised.
New York born and raised.
New York born and raised.
Born in Queens, raised in Brooklyn.
Okay.
Yeah. It's one of those things that only like New Yorkers really pay that much attention to, but mm-hmm. I would hate to to claim being my whole life in Brooklyn when it's just been, you know, three quarters of my life.
Just three quarters of it.
Well, slightly more, I think, possibly, but yeah.
So I feel like I've seen you at events for like the past year plus.
Well, we met at the Food Writers Workshop last year.
Yes.
Week, so yeah, that's been about it here.
We were on a panel with Nicole Taylor.
And Khalid Salam.
Yep.
Yeah.
Shout out to both of them. Yeah. Talking about networking. And it was a great panel you moderated. And then I started to see you at the Beard House a lot, photographing all of the events there.
And kind of everywhere.
Yeah. You are everywhere, yeah. which is fantastic because your photos are great.
Thank you.
So which came first, food or photography?
I mean, food came first and that I've always been eating. But the photography sort of followed my interest in the food, I guess. I did study photography when I was in high school, black and white, darkroom photography, and that was something I was very into. But then I didn't really follow it up in college, and I picked it up again as I was documenting sort of Brooklyn life and what was going on in the food and drink and music and everything that was happening in like the early, you know, say 2005, 2006, 2007. And about then is when I started getting approached to contribute to different blogs and websites when that whole thing was blowing up. And I was doing both writing and shooting, and over time I realized it's the photography that I really enjoyed. Mm-hmm. As I'm sure you know, writing is hard.
Yes.
Photography is hard too, but it's something that for me, I've just been able to keep shooting and getting better while shooting, whereas writing I've always feels like I'm banging my head against the wall and I'm finding a million reasons to put things off until I actually sit down and do it. Whereas, you know, I can I can put together photos of a lot of different things, whether it's whether it's food things or or people on the street or that sort of thing. So,
yeah. Well, one, the banging your head against the wall trying to get your point across is even the more you do it, the more feel like you're doing that.
Right.
But can you talk about photo composition and how you approach food photography? What is it that you feel like you can express through photos that is a bit easier than words?
So I call myself a food photographer only because there isn't a better word for it, or term. I like to say I photograph food in context. I spend a lot of time shooting the whole kitchen, the action that's going on. One of the earliest things I shot that were focused on the food world was Tom Mylan doing a pig butchering demo.
Mm.
I like to cook. I started cooking about 6 months after graduating from college. I realized I couldn't just eat Chinese food every day. I needed to figure out how to sustain myself. And and so in that process, I wanted to learn more about what different food was, where it came from, how food came to the plate, whether it's from the farm or from a garden or from whatever else. What are the actions that were involved? And I was always as much interested in the who and the how as the what.
Hmm.
I don't know if that makes sense, but
no, that definitely makes sense. So, that makes sense.
So when I'm shooting at the kitchen at the James Beard House, I get my food shots, and I mean, I love doing that. That, you know, food is wonderful. I love it. But if I don't know that I could ever just be a studio photographer that spends all day in one place and then just composes images of food and nothing else.
You like going to the subjects and not having it like brought to you so you can.
I mean, it's more just the collaboration access aspect. The part of seeing people working and seeing what they're doing and getting that action, that is a part of all of that. I mean, it's not about, the location of the place. I mean, I do enjoy being able to try out new places and explore the ins and outs of a particular kitchen. But I spend a lot of time at the James Beard House kitchen, and that's the same place, but there's always some new challenge, some new adventure happening mm-hmm. there.
So is there bad food photography, do you think?
Absolutely.
What makes a photo of food bad, in your opinion?
Usually lighting. There are a lot of like terrible, muddy, like or super dark pictures of food. Shots that are too close up. I think that's the easiest way to get a bad photo. If you're trying to photograph in a dark, really warmly lit room, it's going to come out really orange, and it could be an amazing dish, but it's never going to carry over into the photo. But that is not to say, and I see this more than I should. That's not to say that I encourage people to bring their own lights into dining right. rooms, because that's a terrible thing. The photo can be amazing, but it's awful for the experience for literally everyone else around.
Have you done that? Like, as a diner, will you take...
No. Well, I have improvised lighting with, like, my phone or something like that, but I'm not one who's going to turn on the flashlight in the middle of an intimate dining room so that I can make sure
get your food photo.
Get my photo. No, I don't. I really, My wife Tammy is not going to agree with this, but I try not to spend too much time taking pictures of food when it's leisure dining. I mean, I will from time to time because you have to something for the gram, but I try to be in the moment as much as I can.
Do you see diners doing that all the time?
I do. And I mean, you know, I was that person.
Yeah.
For a long time before it became my job, you know, so I understand the impulse. I think that we should try to remember that the reason that we're going out is for the experience, and not just for putting another picture up.
Mm-hmm.
When I want to focus on documenting things, that's when I'm working and that's what I do. You know, if I'm out to dinner with friends or with my wife or with family, I'll take something really quick, but you know, I can take 15 minutes, 20 minutes trying to get a dish right when I'm working. I'm not going to spend more than like 30 seconds on trying to get that right,
right,
you know, when it's leisure time. Now, that's different if I'm with a bunch of people who are doing the same thing.
Right.
I feel like it gives me permission.
You can always tell when a bunch of food media folks are eating together because someone's got the light on their cell phone.
Yeah, right.
You know, every dish, it's like, oh, did you get a picture yet? Did you get a picture? Okay, now we can eat it.
Right.
It's too much sometimes.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I feel like when it's a bunch of food people together, it's sort of kind of work.
Right.
And so that sort of gives us a dispensation for it.
I'm going to use that. Thank you.
Yeah,
now I have an excuse.
Good.
So one of your most recent projects is Black Food Folks with Colleen. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. So Colleen Vincent from the James Beard Foundation and I had worked together at various dinners at the house, and we kept having these conversations about being Black in this industry. And the industry I'm talking about is sort of like a bunch of overlapping industries. It all surrounds food, but there's food service, there's food media, there are food events, there are food producers, you know, but overlapping like the food industry, whether you're a writer or line cook or photographer or whatever, chefs, we both had this experience where we were talking to each other and talking to other people about being Black in this world, in this food world, and how we were always running into the same conversations or running into the same situations, right? I'm sitting with one person who has a wonderful publication that he's launched all on his own, and he's like, this is great, but I can't get funding.
Mm.
I talked to somebody else who's a writer, and it's all about who the editors are. It's all about, you know, we've had this conversation, mm-hmm. right? About you know, what are people going to you for? Are they asking you to do an intro to Black food, right? Is it like another story about, you know, the Soul Food Kitchen that comes out every February, right? Is mm-hmm. it is it about just being, it's always about being pigeonholed in one way or the other, or just not being understood. And so I always had the idea of like, we should just get together a couple people, we'll have a beer, we'll go in the back room of like a bar somewhere and just introduce folks. Because every time we had these conversations, somebody would say, oh, you should talk to blah, blah, blah. You know, you should meet, you're launching a publication. You should talk to Steven Satterfield of Whetstone. You're having trouble finding the right editor for a story about this particular part of, you know, West Indian culture, you should talk to Rochelle at Island Spice. Like, you, there was always that thing, and I feel like the community is so small that we always sort of feel like we know everybody already. Mm-hmm. But it's surprising how many of us there are. Like, I feel like one of the dynamics of this world, this field that we're in, is that we're always sort of made to feel like we're the only one with this voice.
Yeah, it's isolating.
And it is isolating. And so, you know, I just wanted to have like a couple beers or some wine or something in the back room of the bar. And Colleen was like, we should do this for real. And what turned into 20, maybe 30 people, what started out as like 20, maybe 30 people turned into 80 people in Colleen's dad's tax office, which doubles as an event space because West Indians, and that's how we roll.
Correct.
I totally didn't understand when she told me this, and I got there. I was like, okay, Colleen knows what she's doing. I got there, and I saw the space, and I saw the tile walls, and I saw the tent in the back, and I saw the big speakers, and I was like, oh, this is a function.
Yeah.
And it was like, oh yeah, this is going to be perfect. This is amazing. But there's something about, like, the going back to that isolating aspect, there's something about understanding that you know these people. I mean, I knew 3/4 of the people in the room, probably. But seeing them all in the same place, it was amazing, because it really felt like, no, we're really here. And every time we get told, like, oh, this is a niche story, or this is this, or this is that, like, that's bullshit.
Mm-hmm. No, like, it's not. Yeah.
Yeah. There are a lot of us who want to tell these stories, right? And that's all sorts of facets of the industry. That's like whether you're a chef who is just trying to tell your story through food, or a writer who's using words, or me through images. It's like there's something there, and we can help each other. We can talk to each other. We can work together. We can help promote each other's work. We can help connect each other to the right gatekeepers. We can help each other become our own gatekeepers, whatever it is. And so that was amazing. Yeah. I still, Khalid actually, like, I think he commented in one of the Instagram posts about it, look how beautiful we are. And it was just amazing, because it was just this thing, this real moment. And so that was the kickoff. And then last month, or I guess like 2 weeks ago, Colleen and I curated a panel at this year's Food Writers Workshop about appropriation and expertise. Colleen came up with the subject. I at first was a little apprehensive, because I feel like, God, how many times do we have to have the appropriation conversation?
Food, yeah, right? Cultural appropriation.
But then I got it. We had 4 Black women on stage: Clancy Miller, Rochelle Oliver, Vonnie Williams, and Shanika Hillix moderating. And it was a conversation not like the conversations we'd had before, because every other conversation about appropriation centers whiteness. And this conversation was about, okay, how do you cover someone else's culture from non-whiteness, right? What is the perspective? Like, how does that work? How do you learn? How do you approach it respectfully? And I think they had an amazing conversation, and it was great.
It was eye opening for sure. Also, I feel like I say shout out a lot on this show, because it's about community.
Yeah, absolutely.
but Food Rise Workshop, started by Alicia Kennedy, Emily Stevenson, and Layla Schlack.
Yep.
Which Alicia's been on the show twice. All the audio from these conversations are available on their website, and it's just a great organization. But back to the Black Food Folks meeting.
Sure. Yeah.
It's and talking about, you know, the isolation, I think that there's something so empowering when you see people who look like you, who are in the same space, who you don't see all the time, and you talk to them about the things that you're all dealing with.
Right.
And find that common ground. You feel a little less alone even when you step out of those spaces.
Right.
When you go into work, or you go to your home office, or wherever you do your work, you carry that with you, that there's all these people that look like you who are also fighting the same fight.
Yeah, and so on Instagram, the other sort of forum for the group, we have a Facebook page that I don't spend enough time updating, but that's because I've been doing my best to detach myself from Facebook, even though it is work that I need to do, whatever. But the Instagram page for Black Food Folks is largely just my portraits of Black folks in the industry. And partially inspired by the Equity at the Table site and format, it's just the same thing, where even if you're not in New York, even if you're not able to make it to one of our events, you are seeing some other people who are doing work and who you might not have heard of, and that you can now follow and see what they're about.
Excellent. And your book, let's also talk about that.
Right.
111 Rooftops in New York That You Must Not Miss.
Yes.
Tell me about it.
So it is a part of a series of books called 111 Places, from a German publisher called Emmons. Last year, last year we released 111 Places in Queens That You Must Not Miss, and written by Joe DiStefano. I think last time I was here, I was actually talking about that with Kathy Irway and Joe. And so this book is all about rooftop spaces all around the city, and that was an adventure.
You documented it on Instagram, which was a lot of fun to check out.
Yeah, there was a lot of that, because sometimes I just couldn't believe I was there. And sometimes I entirely wished I wasn't there. So I took this on. One of the things that I don't want to say I like to do, but one of the things that I make myself do is whenever I'm in a situation, whenever there's something that I have an aversion to, where I am not entirely comfortable with, if someone comes to me for it, especially for work, I take it. So I don't like, I've never enjoyed public speaking, but when Alicia came to me about doing the panel last year, I said, sure. And I thought that went pretty well. I don't love heights.
That's funny.
And
you're a photographer for, so when this came into your inbox, you were like, I guess I gotta do it.
And so it was mostly fine, but there was more climbing of ladders than I'd really have preferred. One of the book is all about rooftop spaces, mostly accessible throughout New York. So, but there are some green roofs and spaces that are not about the rooftops, right? The rooftops are just decorative, or they're not in a space that someone can walk on, but you can see and appreciate. One of them is the rooftop of the Barclays Center.
Oh my God.
Yeah. It's this giant green roof. And I reached out to the Barclays Center people, and when I got in touch with them, they said, oh, yeah, there's no space to go up there, but what we've done in the past is photograph it from the roof of the Models across the street.
Okay.
I had a surprisingly and slightly unsettlingly easy time convincing the manager at Modell's to let me go in this back room and climb
up
on this roof.
In person,
I just showed up.
Oh, wow. And he was like, yeah, you can go up there.
Yeah. And so he took me back to the stock room, and I climbed up to the sort of second level. And when I got up there, I realized that the entire second level is actually just aluminum scaffolding. And then takes me to a ladder, an iron ladder, at the top of the ladder is the hinged roof, rooftop opening. So I'm walking, and for those out in Radio Land, I'm not a small guy. I'm walking along the scaffolding, and it's wobbling underneath me.
Oh my God.
And I have my camera on me, I have my bag, my whole thing, and so I just strap my bag on my back, climb up there, and hope that I don't fall, because I know I'm going to go right through that scaffolding and fall like 20 feet. I get up on the roof, I get some photos of the Barclays Center, and then try to figure out how I'm getting down there. spoiler, I'm alive. I'm still here. But that was one of the crazier moments in the process, definitely.
Two things. One, I'm sure that picture is amazing. And then also, what a way to go if you had fallen. If you had fallen through the scaffolding, right, like while photographing the Barclays rooftop from the Modell's across the street, right, what a great way to go.
That's my obituary right there.
Right. Yeah. He died doing what he loved.
Right, right.
Convincing people to let him take photographs. Right.
Actually, in the previous book, in the Queen's book that I shot with Joe DiStefano, there is a space. In the book, there's something called the Alley Pond Giant, which is said to be the oldest living organism in the state or the region. It is a 400-odd-year-old tree.
Okay.
And it is in a park off the side of, I don't know, the Crossview Parkway, possibly. I don't drive. My sister drove me to a lot of places as part of that book. Shout out to Shayna. It's in this like green space in a park off the side of this highway, and so I go in and I'm walking, and Google Maps sends me down a path. And I go down this path, and then it says, make a left. I make a left, I go two steps, and there is a 30-foot drop.
Oh, my God.
And so I texted my sister and said, so if I die, I want you to make sure my editor and the author know that it's their fault.
Right.
But again, I'm still here, so
right,
I guess it's worked out.
So you
out.
Made it.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
You made it.
Yeah.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with more of Clay Williams.
Today's program was brought to you by Sushi Master, the new book by Nick Sakagami. Sushi Master is an expert guide to sourcing, making, and enjoying sushi at home. As the only person outside of Japan to earn the designation Osakana Meister, Nick Sakagami introduces the fundamentals of sushi, starting with the fish. Photography from Tokyo's Tsukiji Fish Market offers an inside look at where most of our tuna comes from. And a deep dive into the tools, techniques, and etiquette of sushi ensure you'll never look at a California roll the same way again. Sushi Master comes out on June 4th, 2019.
Are you enjoying this podcast?
Heritage Radio Network has plenty more.
I'm Patrick Martins.
I'm Brandon Hoy.
And I'm Emily Pearson. Together we host The Main Course OG, where we cover food news and culture. Browse episodes of The Main Course OG wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
All right, welcome back. We're here with Clay Williams, photographer extraordinaire, Brooklynite, New York born and raised.
Yes.
I got it right this time. Yes. Okay, good. So let's talk about Slow Food NYC, which you're on the board for.
I am. I'm a new board member, just started this year. And it's a great organization that's about, and I always get this a little mixed up, but it's about good, clean, and fair food. And that's something I feel like we should all be able to get behind. One of the things, it's very tied into the farm-to-table movement. We are very connected to Grow NYC and the green market system. We've worked with a lot of chefs in the past who believe in fair and sustainable practices, both in their businesses and in the food that they're and with who they're sourcing their food from. This year we are hosting our next big fundraiser honoring Nama Tamir at Lighthouse on Monday, May 13th. And all of the funds, pretty much every dollar that Slow Food raises goes to the Urban Harvest Program, which includes a teaching farm garden in East New York called Ujima, and also to grants that go to teachers in the public school system. I feel like it's really important to be able to support that sort of thing, and I'm hoping. I love the whole Slow Food message and what they're about, but it's interesting that this sort of movement of eating local food and supporting local farmers tends to end up with a lot of white folks there, and that's not. I mean, Slow Food has done a great amount in trying to be inclusive and doing panels. They had a panel on labor earlier this year with someone from Brand Workers talking about labor rights and immigration. A lot of things, you know, they've had a lot of other conversations. Karen Washington's been on some of the on one of the panels last year talking about farming. But I would like to bring more voices into the conversation too. And so that was part of why I joined the board this year. And also just because this is a really good cause and it's something that's really important. I know that when I was a kid in Queens before I moved to Brooklyn, my grandmother grew plants in our backyard, grew food in our backyard. She had tomato plants. She had some herbs. She, seeing that was a part of my understanding of food and where it came from. And, you know, everybody doesn't have that. Right. I was very privileged to live in houses with backyards and, growing up. And so I had that understanding early on. I understood that I could grow carrots or I could grow this or that, whatever. Tomatoes, you know. I remember seeing caterpillars in the backyard and, like, understanding another part of the cycle of everything. And having these programs for, you know, for the kids here who don't necessarily have that access, I feel like it's an important thing.
Yeah, it's very important. Yeah. And you said this is your first year on the board.
Yes, I just joined I think February. That's when I started, yeah.
So beyond the event, how can people support Slow Food?
So follow us at Slow Food NYC on Instagram. And we will be having more events throughout the year. We are hoping to have a discussion on grains and heritage grains sometime next month. We're still, everything is in a holding pattern until we get this big fundraiser done. And I'm hoping to have some talks later in the year, maybe the summer, that possibly figures out a way to tie in Black food folks to these same discussions or other groups. It's I really want it. I really want to diversify, not just the conversation, who's having the conversations on the panel, but who's in the audience. Because I think that will do a lot. And I mean, the people involved, the people on the board with me are great. Holly Atkinson is, the queen of social justice. She's out there all the time, raising money and bringing awareness. Taylor Pate, works in food policy, and she also is trying very hard to move forward on these things. Everybody, I'm not going to name check everybody on the board, but they're all really great people, and they want to have more of these conversations.
Yeah.
So I just want to try to help move that forward.
So you talked a little bit about growing up in Queens. Yeah. Do you have any other like early memories of dining?
So it's funny, I knew you were going to ask about that. And so I texted my aunt, when I was 9 years old, I moved to Brooklyn and lived with my aunt, Professor Heather Williams of UPenn. Go out and buy her books, available on Amazon. I texted her asking, hey, so did we eat out a lot when I was living with you in Brooklyn? And she's like, oh no, not really. And then between the two of us, we rattled off like half a dozen places that we went. I mean, it wasn't like fancy or anything, but, but yeah, I mean, there was this one amazing pizza place on Fulton Street in the Fulton Mall. I went to school in Brooklyn Heights and lived in Bed-Stuy. And so it was someplace I passed on the way home, and it had like this super thick real cheese crust and a slightly sweet sauce, and it was just one of those things we kind of obsessed over. So that was a regular thing. It was a takeout joint, so she would pick some up on the way home sometimes. But I mean, you know, she'll say she cooked all the time. I
remember things a little differently.
I will say it was a mix. I'll say it was a mix.
Can you point to a specific restaurant experience that like stands out in your mind beyond the pizza?
It's really funny because the next thing I'm going to say is about more pizza.
I mean, you did grow up in New York. I mean, yeah, pizza's a thing. Yeah. I
like literally just ate pizza here. We would go to Uno's when I was a kid for my birthday, right? There'd be things like that. When I was older in high school, one of my closest friends, still one of my closest friends, Eric, grew up in his father's restaurateur, Ed Schoenfeld of Red Farm. And so he and another friend whose mother was a restaurateur, I believe, knew a lot more about food and eating out and like cooking. And and I remember we would go over to this other friend's house or apartment, and you know, we were just hanging out, but they'd like whip up some guacamole, and I was like, holy crap, I've never like I hadn't even really had guacamole, but much less to know that like you could just throw that together. And so it was like magic to me. And so not an eating out thing, but a thing connecting me with food in a way that I didn't really at the time was still sort of foreign to me.
Mm-hmm. Do you go out to eat a lot now? I know you spend a lot of time shooting food, but leisure food activities.
Leisurely, I would say that the folks from Seamless know me a little too well.
They're very familiar with you eating, and your address.
Yeah, the eating habits in my house. I like to cook, but I don't always have time for it. It's funny whenever I go to these events and I run into the chefs, people always ask me, oh, hey, so when are you coming in? First, I mean, not everyone, I mean, I don't get nearly paid enough to go to all the restaurants. Same. I cover, no matter how much I would love to. But it's also just a matter of the time. The schedule is not always amenable to that sort of thing. So I'm hoping when things slow down come the summer, they'll be able to get out a little bit more.
Do you have like a spot in recent memory that you love?
Oh,
you love to go back to?
Huh. Oh, that's hard. I'm going to feel bad because I'm going to remember something as soon as we're done.
That's okay.
Yeah, I don't know.
We can come back to that.
Okay.
So, you know, I ask every guest about their worst dining experience. Do you have one?
Yeah, I thought about this one too.
And you don't have to name the restaurant, but you can.
I'm not going to. But I had just come from a shoot and was about to grab lunch at a place that I've been in the kitchen before. I photographed the chef or the previous chef and like some of the kitchen staff. I know their PR people a little bit. And so I walked in and the host said, "Caviar?"
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And I was so confused. And he was like, "Are you from Caviar?" And I was like, "No, I'm here to eat." No disrespect to delivery people, but this guy didn't even occur to him.
It didn't even register that he could be there to eat.
I might be a customer and and when I was like, "No, I'm here for lunch," he just sort of shrugged and led me to the table. There was no apology. There was no like, "Oh, hey, sorry." Nothing.
Wow.
I mean, yeah, it was remarkable. And that was, I mean, I haven't been back there since. I did make a note of it and let their PR people know. But I didn't, you know, I didn't make a big deal out of it after.
So for listeners who aren't familiar with Caviar, it's this delivery service here in New York, like Grubhub or Seamless or Uber Eats or any of those.
Yeah.
Wow. Just not even hello, just Caviar?
Right.
Question mark?
Right. Exactly.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, so okay. That's I'm going to have to ask you off air for that restaurant.
Don't worry, I'll tell you.
Okay. Yeah. And my last question for you, if you could have your last meal in a restaurant, where would it be and who is invited?
So I thought about that. It would be in Paris. It would be on or near my birthday because in June, the sunlight just goes on forever. I think sunset is something like after 10. And it's not even about the restaurant so much, although I do know a beautiful space that I don't remember the name. I photographed a chef there a couple years ago, actually on my birthday. But it's in this beautiful little courtyard in the Marais. The food would be awesome, but it's not even important about the food.
Is there anything that would need to be on the table?
Champagne. Champagne and all sorts of deliciousness. One of the places in Paris that my wife and I go to whenever we're there is an Indian place, and I'm again totally forgetting the name. But it's on Canal Saint-Martin, and you know, there would be some of their, they have the best cheese-filled naan, like French cheese.
In naan. Wow.
It's so fantastic. So there would definitely be some of that. There would be oysters. There would be, you know, everything. Yeah.
Who's invited?
I know everybody. You, my wife, my family, my grandmother, who's been dead for like 20 years. Absolutely.
Seated or like everyone's kind of milling around and hanging out?
Both. I mean, there would be seating, but there would also be milling around. Oh, and I thought about this and the only sort of famous person I would want there, or people that I would want there, would be the Obamas.
Okay, the whole family.
I mean, really, Michelle and Barack.
Okay.
Sorry,
Sasha and Malia.
Yeah.
Maybe next time.
Mostly because Tammy would love to meet Michelle.
Okay.
And I wouldn't mind hearing stories. I wouldn't mind hearing what Barack actually has to say about literally everything.
Yeah, that's true. You get off the record.
Yeah.
Barack,
which
is different.
Absolutely.
So you're the first guest to ever like designate a time of year. That's never happened before.
Well, summer's fantastic, and literally I hate every other time of year.
And then I guess you just walk into the canal after that.
I guess, yeah, whatever. That's it.
That's the way to go.
Yeah.
I'm sorry we've talked about your death twice.
All good.
I've never done that to a guest before, so.
I mean, it's sort of implied in the whole, like, last meal thing. It's, you know.
You get to, for me, it's, you know, my last meal is on the beach. I just walk into the ocean.
There you go.
Hopefully people clap. Not at my death, but
right. Right. Yeah.
At my exit.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me. This is great.
And where can people follow you and follow your work?
I am Ultra Clay. That's on Instagram and Twitter. Although I don't know if anyone wants to follow me on Twitter. It's all politics there. And I'm Clay Williams Photo on Facebook, when I remember to be on Facebook. Black Food Folks is at Black Food Folks. And then Slow Food NYC is at Slow Food NYC.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thanks for having me. This was fantastic.
You are welcome back anytime.
Thank you.
The next rooftop series.
Right.
You'll be back.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much for listening. We'll catch you next week on The Hungry Society.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us on Facebook at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.